Chapter 15. I picked up the overturned benches, wiped the soaked floors. I stacked the platters and carried them to the kitchen. I had scrubbed myself in the waves with sand till the blood came through. I'd found the glob of spit on the flagstone and scrubbed that too. It did nothing. With every movement, I could feel the prints of his fingers. The wolves and lions had crept back, shadows in the dark. They lay down, pressing their faces to the floor. At last, when there was nothing else to clean, I sat before the hearth ash. I was not shaking anymore. I did not move at all. My flesh seemed to have congealed around me. My skin stretched over it like a dead thing, rubbery and vile. It was shading to dawn, when the silver horses of the moon go to their stables. My Aunt Selene's chariot had been full all night, her light strong in the sky. By the brightness of her face, I had dragged those monstrous carcasses down to the boat, struck flint, and watched the flames leap up. She would have told Helios by now. My father would appear any moment, the patriarch outraged at the insult to his child. My ceiling would creak as his shoulders pressed against it. Poor child, poor exiled daughter, I should never have let Zeus send you here. The room turned grey, then yellow. A sea breeze stirred, but it was not enough to push away the stink of burnt flesh. My father had never spoken that way in his life, I knew it. But surely, I thought, he would still have to come, if only to reproach me. I was no Zeus, I would not be allowed to strike down 20 men in a moment. I spoke out to the pale edge of my father's rising chariot. Did you hear what I did? The shadows moved across the floor. The light crept over my feet, touched the hem of my dress. Each moment stretched into the next. No one came. Maybe the true surprise, I thought, was that it had not happened sooner. My uncle's eyes used to crawl over me as I poured their wine. Their hands found their way to my flesh. A pinch, a stroke, a hand slipping under the sleeve of my dress. They all had wives. It was not marriage they thought of. One of them would have come for me in the end and paid my father well. Honor on all sides. The light had reached the loom and its cedar scent was rising in the air. The memory of Daedalus's white scarred hands and the pleasure I had taken in them was like a hot wire pushed through my brain. I dug my nails into my wrist. There are oracles scattered across our lands, shrines where priestesses breathe sacred fumes and speak the truths they find in them. Know yourself is carved above their doors, but I had been a stranger to myself, turned to stone for no reason I could name. Daedalus had told me a story once about the lords of Crete who used to hire him to enlarge their houses. He would arrive with his tools, begin taking down the walls, pulling up the floors. But whenever he found some problem underneath that must first be fixed, they frowned. That was not in the agreement. Of course not, he said. It has been hidden in the foundation. But look, there it is, plain as day. See the cracked beam? See the beetles eating the floor? See how the stone is sinking into the swamp? That only made the lords angrier. It was fine until you dug it up. We will not pay. Close it up, plaster over. It has stood this long, it will stand longer. So he would seal that fault up, and the next season the house would fall down. Then they would come to him demanding back their money. I told them, he said to me, I told them and told them. When there is rot in the walls, there is only one remedy. The purple bruise at my throat was turning green at its edges. I pressed it, felt the splintered ache. Tear down, I thought. Tear down and build again. They came. I cannot say why. Some revolution of the fates, some change in trade and shipping routes, some scent upon the air, wafting. Here are nymphs, and they live alone. The boats flew to my harbor as if yanked on a string. The men splashed ashore and looked around, pleased. Fresh water, game, fish, fruits. And I thought I saw hearth smoke above the trees. Is that someone singing? I could have cast an illusion over the island to keep them away. I had the power to do it. Drape my gentle shores in an image of staving rocks and whirlpools, of jagged, unscalable cliffs. They would sail on, and I would never need to see them, nor anyone, again. No, I thought, it is too late for that. I have been found. Let them see what I am. Let them learn the world is not as they think. They climbed up the trails. They crossed the stones of my garden path. They all had the same desperate story. They were lost. They were weary. They were out of food. They would be so grateful for my help. A few of these, so few I can count them on my fingers, I let go. They did not see me as their dinner. They were pious men, honestly lost, and I would feed them, and if there was a handsome one among them, I might take him to my bed. It was not desire, not even its barest scrapings. It was a sort of rage, a knife I used upon myself. I did it to prove my skin was still my own. And did I like the answer I found? Leave, I told them. They knelt to me on my yellow sands. Goddess, they said, at least give us your name so we may send you our thankful prayers. I did not want their prayers, nor my name in their mouths. I wanted them gone. I wanted to scrub myself in the sea until the blood showed through. I wanted the next crew to come so I might see again their tearing flesh. There was always a leader. He was not the largest and need not be the captain, but he was the one they looked to for instruction in their cruelty. He had a cold eye and a coiling tension. Like a snake, the poets might say, but I knew snakes better by then. Give me the honest asp, who strikes me if I trouble him, and not before. I did not send my animals away anymore when men came. I let them loll where they liked, around the garden, under my tables. It pleased me to see the men walk among them, trembling at their teeth and unnatural tameness. I did not pretend to be immortal. I showed my lambent, yellow eyes at every turn. None of it made a difference. I was alone and a woman. That was all that mattered. I set my feasts before them, the meats and cheese, the fruits and fish. I set as well my largest bronze mixing bowl filled to the brim with wine. They gulped and chewed, seized dripping cuts of mutton and dangled them down their throats. They poured and poured again, soaking their lips, slopping the table with red. Bits of barley and herbs stuck to their lips. The bowl is empty, they would say to me. Fill it. Add more honey this time. The vintage has a bitter tang. Of course, I said. The edge came off their hunger. They began to look around. I saw them notice the marble floors, the platters, the fine weave of my clothes. They smirked. If this was what I dared to show them, imagine what might be hiding in the back. Mistress, the leader would say, do not tell me that such a beauty as yourself dwells all alone. Oh, yes, I would answer, quite alone. He would smile. He could not help it. There was never any fear in him. Why should there be? He had already noted for himself there was no man's cloak hanging by the door, no hunter's bow, no shepherd's staff, no sign of brothers or fathers or sons, no vengeance that would follow after. If I were valuable to anyone, I would not be allowed to live alone. I'm sorry to hear it, he said. The bench would scrape and he would stand. The men watched with bright eyes. They wanted the freeze, the flinch, the begging that would come. It was my favorite moment, seeing them frown and try to understand why I wasn't afraid. In their bodies I could feel my herbs like strings waiting to be plucked. I savored their confusion, their dawning fear. Then I plucked them. Their backs bent, forcing them onto hands and knees, faces bloating like drowned corpses. They thrashed and the benches turned over, wine splattered the floor. Their screams broke into squeals. I am certain it hurt. I kept the leader for last so he could watch. He shrank, pressed against the wall. Please spare me, spare me, spare me. No, I would say. Oh, no. When it was over, it remained only to drive them out to the pen. I raised my staff of ash wood, and they ran. The gate closed after them, and they pressed back against the posts, their piggy eyes still wet with the last of their human tears. My nymphs said not a word, though I suspected they watched sometimes through the crack of the door. Mistress Circe, another ship. Shall we go back to our room? Please, and pull out the wine for me before you go. From one task to another I went, weaving, working, slopping my pigs, crossing and recrossing the aisle. I moved straight-backed, as if a great brimming bowl rested in my hands. The dark liquid rippled as I walked, always at the point of overflow, yet never flowing. Only if I stopped, if I lay down, did I feel it begin to bleed. Brides, nymphs were called, but that is not really how the world saw us. We were an endless feast laid out upon a table, beautiful and renewing, and so very bad at getting away. The rails of my sty cracked with age and use. From time to time the wood buckled and a pig escaped. Most often he would throw himself from the cliffs. The seabirds were grateful. They seemed to come from half the world away to feast on the plump bones. I would stand watching as they stripped the fat and sinew. The small pink scrap of tail skin dangled from one of their beaks like a worm. If it were a man, I wondered if I would pity him, but it was not a man. When I passed back by the pen, his friends would stare at me with pleading faces. They moaned and squealed and pressed their snouts to the earth. "We are sorry, we are sorry." "Sorry you were caught," I said. "Sorry that you thought I was weak, but you were wrong." On my bed, the lions rested their chins on my stomach. I pushed them off. I rose and walked again. He asked me once, "Why pigs?" We were seated before my hearth in our usual chairs. He liked the one draped in cowhide, with silver inlaid in its carvings. Sometimes he would rub the scrolling absently beneath his thumb. "Why not?" I said. He gave me a bare smile. "I mean it. I would like to know." I knew he meant it. He was not a pious man, but the seeking out of things hidden. This was his highest worship. There were answers in me. I felt them, buried deep as last year's bulbs, growing fat, their roots tangled with those moments I had spent against the wall, when my lions were gone, and my spells shut up inside me and my pigs screamed in the yard. After I changed a crew, I would watch them scrabbling and crying in the sty, falling over each other, stupid with their horror. They hated it all. Their newly voluptuous flesh, their delicate split trotters, their swollen bellies dragging in the earth's muck. It was a humiliation, a debasement. They were sick with longing for their hands, those appendages men used to mitigate the world. "Come," I would say to them, "it's not that bad. You should appreciate a pig's advantages. Mud slick and swift, they are hard to catch. Low to the ground, they cannot easily be knocked over. They are not like dogs. They do not need your love. They can thrive anywhere, on anything, scraps and trash. They look witless and dull, which lulls their enemies, but they are clever. They will remember your face." They never listened. The truth is, men make terrible pigs. In my chair by the hearth, I lifted my cup. "Sometimes," I told him, "you must be content with ignorance." He did not like that answer, yet that was the perversity of him. In a way, he liked it best of all. I had seen how he could shuck truths from men like oyster shells, how he could pry into a breast with a glance and a well-timed word. So little of the world did not yield to his sounding. In the end, I think the fact that I did not was his favorite thing about me. But I am ahead of myself now. "A ship," the nymph said, "very patched, with eyes upon the hull." That caught my attention. Common pirates did not have the gold to waste on paint. But I did not go look. The anticipation was part of the pleasure. The moment when the knock came and I would rise from my herbs, swing wide the door. There were no pious men anymore, they had not been for a long time. The spell was polished in my mouth as a river stone. I added a handful of roots to the draught I was making. There was moly in it, and the liquid gleamed. The afternoon passed, and the sailors did not appear. My nymphs reported they were camped on the beach with their fires burning. Another day went by, and at last on the third day came the knock. That painted ship of theirs was the finest thing about them. Their faces had lines like grandfather's. Their eyes were bloodshot and dead. They flinched from my animals. "Let me guess," I said. "You are lost. You are hungry and tired and sad." They ate well. They drank more. Their bodies were lumpish here and there with fat, though the muscles beneath were hard as trees. Their scars were long, ridged, and slashing. They had had a good season, then met someone who did not like their thieving. They were plunderers, of that I had no doubt. Their eyes never stopped counting up my treasures, and they grinned at the tally they came to. I did not wait any more for them to stand and come at me. I raised my staff, I spoke the word. They went crying to their pen like all the rest. The nymphs were helping me set right the toppled benches and scrub away the wine stains when one of them glanced at the window. "Mistress," another on the path. I had thought the crew too small to man a full ship. Some of them must have waited on the beach, and now one had been sent to scout after his fellows. The nymphs set out new wine and slipped away. I opened the door at the man's knock. The late sun fell on him, picking out the red in his neat beard, the faint silver in his hair. He wore a bronze sword at his waist. He was not so tall as some, but strong, I saw, his joints well seasoned. "Lady," he said, "my crew has taken shelter with you. I hope I may as well." I put all my father's brightness into my smile. "You are as welcome as your friends." I watched him while I filled the cups. Another thief, I thought, but his eyes only grazed my rich trappings. They lingered instead on a stool, still upended on the floor. He bent down and set it upright. "Thank you," I said. "My cats, they are always tumbling something." "Of course," he said. I brought him food and wine and led him to my hearth. He took the goblet and sat in the silver chair I indicated. I saw him wince a little as he bent, as if at the pull of recent wounds. A jagged scar ran up his muscled calf from heel to thigh, but it was old and faded. He gestured with his cup. "I have never seen a loom like that," he said. "Is it an Eastern design?" 1,000 of his kind had passed through this room. They had catalogued every inch of gold and silver, but not one had ever noticed the loom. I hesitated for the briefest moment. "Egyptian." "Ah, they make the best things, don't they? Clever to use a second beam instead of loom weights. So much more efficient to draw the weft down. I would love to have a sketch." His voice was resonant, warm, with a pull to it that reminded me of ocean tides. "My wife would be thrilled. Those weights used to drive her mad. She kept saying someone ought to invent something better. Alas, I have not found time to apply myself to it. One of my many husbandly failings." "My wife." The words jarred me. If any of the men in all those crews had had a wife, they never mentioned her. He smiled at me, his dark eyes on mine. His goblet was lifted loosely in his hand, as if any moment he would drink. "Though the truth is, her favorite thing about weaving is that while she works, everyone around her thinks she can't hear what they're saying. She gathers all the best news that way. She can tell you who's getting married, who's pregnant, and who's about to start a feud."
"Your wife sounds like a clever woman."
"She is. I cannot account for the fact that she married me, but since it is to my benefit, I try not to bring it to her attention."
It surprised me to a huff of laughter. What man spoke so? None that I had ever met. Yet at the same time, there was something in him that felt nearly familiar.
"Where is your wife now, on your ship?" "At home, thank the gods. I would not make her sail with such a ragged bunch. She runs the house better than any regent."
My attention was sharp on him now. Common sailors did not talk of regents, nor look so at home next to silver inlay. He was leaning on the carved arm of the chair as if it were his bed.
"You call your crew ragged," I said. "They seem no different from other men to me."
"You are kind to say so, but half the time I'm afraid they behave like beasts," he sighed.
"It's my fault. As their captain, I should keep them in better line, but we have been at war, and you know how that can tarnish even the best men. And these, though I love them well, will never be called best."
He spoke confidingly as if I understood, but all I knew of war came from my father's stories of the Titans. I sipped my wine.
"War has always seemed to me a foolish choice for men. Whatever they win from it, they will only have a handful of years to enjoy before they die. More likely, they will perish trying."
"Well, there is the matter of glory. But I wish you could have spoken to our general. You might have saved us all a lot of trouble."
"What was the fight over?"
"Let me see if I can remember the list." He ticked his fingers. "Vengeance, lust, hubris, greed, power. What have I forgotten? Ah, yes, vanity and pique."
"Sounds like a usual day among the gods," I said.
He laughed and held up his hand. "It is your divine privilege to say so, my lady. I will only give thanks that many of those gods fought on our side."
Divine privilege. He knew I was a goddess then. But he showed no awe. I might be his neighbor whose fence he leaned over to discuss the fig harvest.
"Gods fought among mortals. Who?"
"Hera, Poseidon, Aphrodite, Athena, of course."
I frowned. I had heard nothing of this. But then I had no way to hear anymore. Hermes was long gone.
My nymphs did not care for worldly news, and the men who sat at my tables thought only of their appetites. My days had narrowed to the ambit of my eyes and my fingers' ends.
"Fear not," he said. "I will not tax your ear with the whole long tale, but that is why my men are so scraggled. We were 10 years fighting on Troy's shores, and now they are desperate to get back to home and hearth."
10 years? Troy must be a fortress.
Oh, she was stout enough, but it was our weakness that drew the war out, not her strength.
This too surprised me. Not that it was true, but that he would admit it. It was disarming, that wry deprecation.
"It is a long time to be away from home."
"And now it is longer still. We sailed from Troy 2 years ago. Our journey back has been somewhat more difficult than I would have wished."
"So there is no need to worry about the loom," I said. "By now your wife will have given up on you and invented a better one herself."
His expression remained pleasant, but I saw something shift in it.
"Most likely you are right. She will have doubled our lands too. I would not be surprised."
"And where are these lands of yours?"
"Near Argos. Cows and barley, you know."
"My father keeps cows himself," I said. "He favors a pure white hide."
"They are hard to breed true. He must husband them well."
"Oh, he does," I said.
"He cares for nothing else."
I was watching him. His hands were wide and calloused. He gestured with his cup, now here, now there, sloshing his wine a little, but never spilling it, and never once touching it to his lips. "I am sorry," I said, "that my vintage is not to your liking." He looked down as if surprised to see the cup still in his hand.
"My apologies. I've been so much enjoying the hospitality, I forgot."
He rapped his knuckles on his temple.
"My men say I would forget my head if it weren't on my neck. Where did you say they've gone again?" I wanted to laugh. I felt giddy, but I kept my voice as even as his.
"They're in the back garden.
There's an excellent bit of shade to rest in." "I confess I'm in awe," he said. "They're never so quiet for me. You must have had quite an effect on them."
I heard a humming, like before a spell is cast.
His gaze was a honed blade. All this had been prologue.
As if we were in a play, we stood.
"You have not drunk," I said. "That is clever. But I'm still a witch, and you are in my house. I hope we may settle this with reason."
He had put the goblet down. He did not draw his sword, but his hand rested on the hilt.
"Weapons do not frighten me, nor the sight of my own blood." "You are braver than most gods, then. I once saw Aphrodite leave her son to die on the field over a scratch."
"Witches are not so delicate," I said. His sword hilt was hacked from 10 years of battles, his scarred body braced and ready. His legs were short but stiff with muscles. My skin prickled. He was handsome, I realized.
"Tell me," I said, "what is in that bag you keep so close at your waist?" "A herb I found."
"Black roots," I said. "White flowers?"
"Just so. Mortals cannot pick moly."
"No," he said, simply. "They cannot."
"Who was it? No, never mind, I know."
I thought of all the times Hermes had watched me harvest, pressed me about my spells.
"If you had the moly, why did you not drink? He must have told you that no spell I cast could touch you."
"He did tell me," he said. "But I have a quirk of prudence in me that's hard to break. The trickster lord, for all I am grateful to him, is not known for his reliability. Helping you turn me into a swine would be just his sort of jest."
"Are you always so suspicious?"
"What can I say?" He held out his palms. "The world is an ugly place. We must live in it."
"I think you are Odysseus," I said,
"born from that same trickster's blood." He did not start at the uncanny knowledge. He was a man used to gods.
"And you are the goddess Circe, daughter of the sun."
My name in his mouth, it sparked a feeling in me, sharp and eager. It was like ocean tides indeed, I thought. You could look up and the shore would be gone. "Most men do not know me for what I am."
"Most men, in my experience, are fools," he said. "I confess you nearly made me give the game away. Your father, the cowherd."
He was smiling, inviting me to laugh, as if we were two mischievous children.
"Are you a king? A lord?
A prince?" "Then, Prince Odysseus, we are at an impasse. For you have the moly, and I have your men. I cannot harm you, but if you strike at me, they will never be themselves again.
I feared as much, he said. And, of course, your father Helios is zealous in his vengeances. I imagine I would not like to see his anger.
Helios would never defend me, but I would not tell Odysseus that.
You should understand your men would have robbed me blind.
I am sorry for that. They are fools and young, and I have been too lenient with them.
It was not the first time he had made that apology. I let my eyes rest on him, take him in. He reminded me a little of Daedalus, his evenness and wit. But beneath his ease I could feel a royal that Daedalus never had. I wanted to see it revealed.
Perhaps we might find a different way. His hand was still on his hilt, but he spoke as if we were only deciding dinner.
What do you propose?
Do you know, I said. Hermes told me a prophecy about you once.
Oh, and what was it?
That you were fated to come to my halls.
And?
That was all. He lifted an eyebrow.
I'm afraid that's the dullest prophecy I've ever heard.
I laughed. I felt poised as a hawk on a crag. My talons still held the rock, but my mind was in the air.
I propose a truce, I said. A test of sorts.
What sort of test? He leaned forward a little. It was a gesture I would come to know. Even he could not hide everything. Any challenge, he would run to meet it. His skin smelled of labor and the sea. He knew 10 years of stories. I felt keen and hungry as a barren spring.
I have heard, I said, that many find their trust in love.
It surprised him, and oh, I liked the flash of that before he covered it over.
My lady, only a fool would say no to such an honor. But in truth, I think also only a fool would say yes. I am a mortal. The moment I set down the moly to join you in your bed, you may cast your spell.
He paused.
Unless, of course, you were to swear an oath you would not hurt me upon the river of the dead.
An oath by the river Styx would hold even Zeus himself.
You are careful, I said.
It seems we share that.
No, I thought. I was not careful. I was reckless, headlong.
He was another knife. I could feel it. A different sort, but a knife still.
I did not care. I thought, give me the blade. Some things are worth spilling blood for.
I will swear that oath, I said.
Chapter 16. Later, years later, I would hear a song made of our meeting. The boy who sang it was unskilled, missing notes more often than he hit, yet the sweet music of the verses shone through his mangling. I was not surprised by the portrait of myself, the proud witch undone before the hero's sword, kneeling and begging for mercy. Humbling women seems to me a chief pastime of poets, as if there can be no story unless we crawl and weep. We lay together in my wide, gold bed. I had wanted to see him loosened with pleasure, passionate, laid bare. He was never laid bare, but the rest I saw. We did find some trust between us.
I am not really from Argos, he said. The firelight flickered over us, casting long shadows across the sheets. My island is Ithaca. It's too stony for cows. We run to goats and olive groves.
And the war? A fiction also?
The war was real.
There was no rest in him. He looked as though he could have parried a spear thrust out of the shadows. Yet the weariness had begun to show through, like rocks when the tide recedes.
By the law of guests, I should not question him before he had fed and refreshed himself. But we were past such observances.
You said your journey was difficult.
I sailed from Troy with 12 ships.
His face in the yellow light was like an old shield, battered and lined.
We are all that is left.
In spite of myself, I was shocked. 11 ships was more than 500 men lost.
How did such disaster strike you?
He recited the story as if he were giving a recipe for meat. The storms that had blown them half across the world, the lands filled with cannibals and vengeful savages, with sybarites who drugged their wills. They had been ambushed by the cyclops Polyphemus, a savage one-eyed giant who was a son of Poseidon. He had eaten 6 men and sucked their bones. Odysseus had had to blind him to escape, and now Poseidon hunted them across the waves in vengeance.
No wonder he limped.
No wonder he was grey. This is a man who has faced monsters. And now Athena, who was ever my guide, has turned her back. I was not surprised to hear her name. The clever daughter of Zeus honored wiles and invention above all. He was just the sort of man she would cherish. What offended her? I was not sure he would answer, but he drew in a long breath. War breeds many sins, and I was not last in committing them. When I asked her pardon, she always gave it. Then the sack of the city came, temples were razed, blood spilled on altars. It was the greatest sacrilege, gore upon the holy objects of the gods. I was part of such things with the rest, but when the other stayed to offer her prayers, I did not stay with him. I was impatient.
10 years you had fought, I said. It is understandable.
You are kind, but I think we both know it is not. As soon as I was on board, the seas around me lifted wrathful heads. The sky darkened to iron. I tried to turn the fleet around, but it was too late. A storm spun us far off from Troy.
He rubbed his knuckles as if they ached.
Now when I speak to her, she does not answer.
Disaster upon disaster. Yet he had walked into a witch's house, even weary as he was and raw with grief.
He had sat at my hearth, showing no hint of anything but charm and smiles.
What resolve that must have taken, what vigilant will. But no man is infinite. Exhaustion stained his face.
His voice was hoarse. A knife I had named him. But I saw that he was sliced down to the bone. I felt an answering ache in my chest. When I had taken him to my bed, it had been a kind of dare. But the feeling that flickered in me now was much older. There he was, his flesh open before me. This is something torn that I can mend. I held the thought in my hand. When that first crew had come, I had been a desperate thing, ready to fawn on anyone who smiled at me. Now I was a fell witch, proving my power with sty after sty. It reminded me suddenly of those old tests Hermes used to set me. Would I be skimmed milk or a harpy? A foolish girl or a villainous monster? Those could not still be the only choices. I reached for his hands and drew him up. Odysseus, son of Laertes, you have been hard-pressed. You are dry as leaves in winter, but there is harbor here. The relief in his eyes ran warm over my skin. I led him to my hall and commanded my nymphs to see to his comforts, to fill a silver bath for him and wash his sweated limbs, bring him fresh clothes. After, he stood shining and clean before the tables we had heaped with food, but he did not move to take his seat. "Forgive me," he said, his eyes on mine. "I cannot eat." I knew what he wanted. He did not storm or beg, only waited for my decision. The air felt limned in gold around me. "Come," I said. I strode down the hall and out to the sty. Its gates swung wide at my touch. The pigs squealed, but when they saw him behind me, their terror eased. I brushed each snout with oil and spoke a charm. Their bristles fell away, and they rose to their feet as men. They ran to him, weeping and pressing their hands to his. He wept as well, not loudly but in great streams, until his beard was wet and dark. They looked like a father and his wayward sons. How old had they been when he'd left for Troy? Scarcely more than boys, most of them. I stood a little distant, like a shepherd watching a flock. "Be welcome," I said when their tears had slowed. "Draw your ship up on the beach and bring your fellows. All of you are welcome." They ate well that night, laughing, toasting. They looked younger, new-made in their relief. Odysseus's weariness too was gone. I watched him from my loom, interested to see another facet. The commander with his men. He was as good at that as all the rest. Amused at their antics, gently reproving, reassuringly untroubled. They circled him like bees their hive. When the platters were empty and the men drooped on their benches, I gave them blankets and told them to find beds wherever they were comfortable. A few stretched out in empty rooms, but most went outside to sleep beneath the summer stars. Only Odysseus remained. I led him to the silver chair at the hearth and poured wine. His face was pleasant, and he leaned forward again, as if eager for whatever I might offer. "The loom you admired," I said. "It was made by the craftsman Daedalus. You know the name?" I was gratified to see genuine surprise and pleasure. "No wonder it is such a marvel. May I?" I inclined my head and he went to it at once. With a hand he ran its beams base to top. His touch was reverent, like a priest at an altar.
How did you come to have it?
A gift. There was speculation in his eyes, bright curiosity, but he did not press further. Instead, he said, When I was a boy, and everyone played at wrestling monsters like Heracles, I dreamed of being Daedalus instead. It seemed the greater genius to look at raw wood and iron and imagine marvels. I was disappointed to find out I did not have the talent for it. I was always cutting my fingers open. I thought of the white scars on Daedalus's hands, but I held back. His hand rested on the sidebeam as if upon the head of a beloved dog. May I watch you weave with it? I was not used to having anyone so close while I worked. The yarn seemed to thicken and tangle in my fingers. His eyes followed every motion. He asked me questions about what each piece did and how it differed from other looms. I answered him as best I could, though at last I had to confess that I had no comparison. This is the only loom I have ever used. Imagine such a happiness, like drinking wine your whole life instead of water, like having Achilles to run your errands. I did not know the name. His voice rolled like a bard's. Achilles, prince of Thea, swiftest of all the Greeks, best of the Achaean warriors at Troy, beautiful, brilliant, born from the dread Nereid Thetis, graceful and deadly as the sea itself. The Trojans had fallen before him like grass before the scythe, and the mighty prince Hector himself had perished at his ash spear's end. You did not like him, I said. Some inward amusement touched his face. I appreciated him, in his way, but he made a terrible soldier, however many men he could bleed. He had a number of inconvenient ideas about loyalty and honor. Every day was a new struggle to yoke him to our purpose, keep him straight in his furrow. Then the best part of him died, and he was even more difficult after that. But as I said, his mother was a goddess, and prophecies hung on him like ocean weed. He wrestled with matters larger than I will ever understand. It was not a lie, but it was not truth either. He had named Athena as his patron. He had walked with those who could crack the world like eggs. What was his best part? His lover, Patroclus. He didn't like me much, but then the good ones never do. Achilles went mad when he died, nearly mad anyway. I had turned from the loom by then. I wanted to watch his face as he talked. Through the windows, the dark sky was ebbing to grey. A wolf sighed on her paws. I saw him hesitate at last. Lady Circe, he said, Golden Witch of Aiaia, you gave us mercy and we needed it. Our ship is splintered. The men are close to breaking. I am ashamed to ask for more, but I think I must. In my dearest hopes, we stay a month. Is it too long? A burst of joy, like honey in my throat. I kept my face steady, though. I do not think a month should be too long. He spent his days working on the ship. In the evenings, we would sit before the hearth while the men ate their suppers, and at night he came to my bed. His shoulders were thick, carved from his warrior hours. I ran my hands across his ragged scars. There were pleasures there, but in truth the greater pleasure was after. When we lay together in the darkness and he told me stories of Troy, conjuring the war for me spear by spear. Proud Agamemnon, leader of the host, brittle as badly tempered iron. Menelaus, his brother, whose wife Helen's abduction had begun the war. Brave, dull-brained Ajax, built like a mountainside. Diomedes, Odysseus's ruthless right hand. And then the Trojans, handsome Paris, laughing thief of Helen's heart. His father, white-bearded Priam, king of Troy, beloved by the gods for his gentleness. Hecuba, his queen with a warrior's spirit, whose womb had borne so many noble fruits. Hector, her eldest, noble heir and bulwark to his great walled city. And Odysseus, I thought, the spiral shell, always another curve out of sight. I began to see what he'd meant when he had talked of his army's weakness. It was not their sinews that had wavered, but their discipline. There had never been a parade of prouder men, more fractious and unyielding, each certain the war would fail without them. Do you know who truly wins wars? He asked me one night. We lay on the rugs at the foot of my bed. Moment by moment, his vitality had returned. His eyes were bright now, stormlit. When he talked, he was lawyer and bard and crossroads charlatan at once, arguing his case, entertaining, pulling back the veil to show you the secrets of the world. It was not just his words, though they were clever enough. It was everything together. His face, his gestures, the sliding tones of his voice. I would say it was like a spell he cast, but there was no spell I knew that could equal it. The gift was his alone.
The generals take the credit, of course, and indeed they provide the gold. But they are always calling you into their tent and asking for reports of what you're doing instead of letting you go do it. The songs say it is heroes. They are another piece. When Achilles puts on his helmet and cleaves his red path through the field, the hearts of common men swell in their chests. They think of the stories that will be told, and they long to be in them. I fought beside Achilles. I stood shield to shield with Ajax. I felt the wind and fan of their great spears. Those soldiers, of course, are yet another piece. For though they are weak and unsteady, when they are harnessed together, they will carry you to victory. But there is a hand that must gather all those pieces and make them whole. A mind to guide the purpose, and not flinch from war's necessities.
And that is your part, I said. Which means you are like Daedalus after all. Only instead of wood, you work in men. The look he gave me, like purest, unmixed wine. After Achilles died, Agamemnon named me best of the Greeks. Other men fought bravely, but they flinched from war's true nature. Only I had the stomach to see what must be done. His chest was bare and hatched with scars. I tapped it lightly, as if sounding what lay within, such as,
"You promise mercy to spies so they will spill their story, then you kill them after. You beat men who mutiny. You coax heroes from their sulks. You keep spirits high at any cost. When the great hero Philoctetes was crippled with a festering wound, the men lost their courage over it. So I left him behind on an island and claimed he had asked to be left. Ajax and Agamemnon would have battered at Troy's locked gates until they died, but it was I who thought of the trick of the giant horse, and I spun the story that convinced the Trojans to pull it inside. I crouched in the wooden belly with my picked men, and if any shook with terror and strain, I put my knife to his throat. When the Trojans finally slept, we tore through them like foxes among soft-feathered chicks." These were no songs to sing before a court, no tales from the great golden age. Yet somehow in his mouth they did not seem dishonorable, but just and inspired and wisely pragmatic. "Why did you go to war in the first place if you knew what the other kings were like?" He rubbed at his cheek.
"Oh, because of a foolish oath I swore. I tried to get out of it. My son was a year old, and I still felt new married. There would be other glories, I thought, and when Agamemnon's man came to collect me, I pretended to be mad. I went out naked and began ploughing a winter field. He put my infant son in the blade's path. I stopped, of course, and so I was collected with the rest."
A bitter paradox, I thought. To keep his son, he had to lose him.
"You must have been angry."
He lifted his hands, let them drop.
"The world is an unjust place. Look what happened to that counselor of Agamemnon's. Palamedes, his name was. He served the army well, but fell in a pit while on a night watch. Someone had set sharpened stakes in the bottom. Terrible loss."
His eyes glittered.
"If good Patroclus had been there, he might have said, 'Sir, you are no true hero, no Heracles, no Jason. You speak no honest speeches from pure heart. You do no noble deeds in the gleaming sunlight.' But I had met Jason, and I knew what sort of deeds could be done in the sun's sight. I said nothing." The days passed and the nights with them. My house was crowded with some 4 dozen men, and for the first time in my life, I found myself steeped in mortal flesh. Those frail bodies of theirs took relentless attention, food and drink, sleep and rest, the cleaning of limbs and fluxes. Such patience mortals must have, I thought, to drag themselves through it hour after hour. The fifth day, Odysseus's awl slipped and punctured the pad of his thumb. I gave him salves and worked my charms to drive off infection, but it still took half a moon to heal. I watched the pain passing over his face. Now it hurt, and now still it hurt, and now.
And that was only one among his discomforts, stiff neck and acid stomach and the ache of old wounds.
I ran my hands over his ribbed scars, easing him as I could. The scars themselves I offered to wipe away. He shook his head. How would I know myself? I was secretly glad. They suited him. Enduring Odysseus he was, and the name was stitched into his skin. Whoever saw him must salute and say, there is a man who has seen the world. There is a captain with stories to tell. I might have told him, in those hours, stories of my own. Scylla and Glaucus, Aeetes, the Minotaur. The stone wall cutting into my back, the floor of my hall wet with blood reflecting the moon. The bodies I had dragged one by one down the hill and burned with their ship. The sound flesh makes when it tears and reforms, and how, when you change a man, you may stop the transformation partway through, and then that monstrous, half-beast thing will die. His face would be intent as he listened, his relentless mind examining, weighing, and cataloguing. However I pretended I could conceal my thoughts as well as he, I knew it was not true. He would see down to my bones. He would gather my weaknesses up and set them with the rest of his collection, alongside Achilles's and Ajax's. He kept them on his person as other men keep their knives. I looked down at my body, bare in the fire's light, and tried to imagine it written over with its history. My palm with its lightning streak, my hand missing its fingers, the thousand cuts from my witch work, the gristled furrows of my father's fire, the skin of my face like some half-melted taper, and those were only the things that had left marks. There would be no salutes. What had Aeetes called an ugly nymph? A stain upon the face of the world. My smooth belly glowed beneath my hand, the color of honey shining in the sun. I drew him down to me. I was a golden witch who had no past at all. I began to know his men a little, those unsteady hearts that he had spoken of, those leaky vessels. Polites was better mannered than the rest, Eurylochus stubborn and sulky. Thin-faced Elpenor had a laugh like a screechy owl. They reminded me of wolf pups, their griefs gone when their bellies were full. They looked down when I passed, as if to be sure their hands were still their own. Every day they spent at games. They held races through the hills and on the beach. They were always running up to Odysseus, panting. Will you judge our archery contest, our discus throw, our spears? Sometimes he would go off smiling with them, but sometimes he would shout or strike them. He was not so easy and even as he pretended. Living with him was like standing beside the sea. Each day a different color, a different foam-capped height, but always the same restless intensity pulling towards the horizon. When the rail broke on his ship, he kicked it out in fury and threw the pieces into the sea. The next day he went grimly to the forest with his axe, and when Eurylochus offered to help him, he bared his teeth. He could still marshal himself, show the face he must have worn each day to harness Achilles, but it cost him, and after he was prone to moods and tempers. The men would slink away, and I saw confusion on their faces. Daedalus had said to me once, even the best iron grows brittle with too much beating. I was smooth as oil, calm as windless water. I drew him out, asked him for stories of his travels among foreign lands and men. He told me of the armies of Memnon, son of the Dawn, king of Ethiopia, and the Amazon horsewomen with their crescent shields. He had heard that in Egypt some of their pharaohs were women dressed in men's clothes. In India, he'd heard, there were ants the size of foxes who dig up gold among the dunes. And to the far north were a people who did not believe that Oceanus's river circled the earth, but instead it was a great girdling serpent, thick around as a boat and always hungry. It could never be still, for its appetite drove it ever onwards, devouring everything bite by bite, and one day, when it had eaten all the world, it would devour itself. But however far afield he travelled, always he came back to Ithaca. His olive groves and his goats, his loyal servants and the excellent hunting dogs he'd raised by hand, his noble parents and his old nurse and his first boar hunt which had given him the long scar I had seen on his leg. His son, Telemachus, would be bringing the herds down from the mountains by now. He will be good with them. I always was. Every prince needs to know his lands, and there's no better way to learn than by grazing the goats. He never said, what if I go home and all of it is ash? But I saw the thought in him, living like a second body and feeding in the dark. It was autumn by then, the light thinning, the grass crackling underfoot. The month was nearly gone. We were lying in my bed.
I think we must leave very soon, or else stay the winter.
The window was open, the breeze passed over us. It was a trick of his, to set a sentence out like a plate on a table and see what you would put on it. But he surprised me by continuing.
I would stay, he said, if you would have me. It will only be until spring. I will go as soon as the seas are passable. It will be scarcely any delay.
That last was not said to me, but to some person he argued with silently. His men, perhaps, his wife. I did not care. I kept my face turned away so he would not see my pleasure. I will have you, I said. Something shifted in him after that, the releasing of a tension I had not realized he held. The next day he went humming down to the shore with his crew. They dragged the ship into a sheltered cave. They staked it, rolled the sail, stowed all the gear to keep it safely through the winter storms till spring. Sometimes I would see him watching me. An intentness would come over his face, and he would begin to ask me his casual, sideways questions about the island, about my father, the loom, my history, witchcraft. I had come to know that look well. It was the same he wore when he spotted a crab with a triple claw, or wandered over the trick tides of Aiaia's East Bay. The world was made of mysteries, and I was only another riddle among the millions. I did not answer him, and though he pretended frustration, I began to see that it pleased him in some strange way. A door that did not open at his knock was a novelty in its own right, and a kind of relief as well. All the world confessed to him. He confessed to me. Some stories he told me by daylight. Others came only when the fire was burnt out and there was no one to know his face but the shadows. It was after the Cyclops, he said. We had a bit of luck at last. We landed on the island of the winds. You know it? King Aeolus, I said. One of Zeus's pets whose job it was to keep track of the gusts that spin ships across the world. I pleased him and he sped us on our way. He gave me, besides, a great bag holding all of the contrary winds, so that they could not trouble us. For 9 days and 9 nights, we skimmed across the waves. I did not sleep, not even for an hour, for I was guarding the bag. I had told my men what it was, of course, but... He shook his head. They decided it was treasure I did not wish to share. The portions they had received from Troy had been long lost in the waves. They did not want to come home empty-handed. Well, he drew a deep breath. You may imagine what happened. I did imagine it. His men were unrulier than ever now, giddy with the prospect of a whole winter's idleness. At night, they liked to play a game of throwing wine dregs. They picked some trencher as the target, but their aim was terrible, for by then they had drunk down bowl after bowl. The table grew stained as if with slaughter, and they looked to my nymphs to clear it up. When I told them they would do it themselves, they eyed each other, and if I had been anyone else, they would have defied me. But they still remembered their snouts. At last, when I could fight it no longer, Odysseus said, I fell asleep. I did not feel them take the bag from my hand. It was the howling of the winds that woke me. They whirled out of the bag and blew us back as if we had never left. Every league undone. They think I grieve for their dead comrades, and I do. But sometimes it is all I can do not to kill them myself. They have wrinkles, but no wisdom. I took them to war before they could do any of those things that steady a man. They were unmarried when they left. They had no children. They had no years of lean harvest when they must scrape the bottoms of their stores, and no good years either that they might learn to save. They had not seen their parents grow old and begin to fail. They have not seen them die. I fear I have robbed them not only of their youth, but their age as well. He rubbed at his knuckles. He had been a bowman when he was young, and the strength it takes to string and knock and shoot taxes hands like nothing else. He had left his bow behind when he went to war, but the pain had followed him. He told me once that if he had brought the bow, he would have been the best archer in both armies. Then why leave it? Politics, he explained. The bow was Paris's weapon. Paris, the pretty wife-stealer. Among heroes, he was seen as cowardly. No bowman would ever have been made best of the Greeks, no matter how skilled he was. Heroes are fools, I had said. He had laughed.
We are agreed.
His eyes were closed. He was silent so long I thought he slept. Then he said,
If you could have seen how close we were to Ithaca, I could smell the fishing fires from the beach.
I began to ask him for small favors. Would he kill a buck for dinner? Would he catch a few fish? My sty was falling to pieces. Might he mend some of the posts? It gave me a sharp pleasure to see him come in the door with full nets, with baskets of fruit from my orchards. He joined me in the garden staking vines. We spoke of what winds were blowing, how Elpenor had taken to sleeping on the roof, and whether we should forbid it.
That idiot, he said, he will break his neck.
I will tell him he only has permission when he's sober, he snorted.
That will be never.
I knew I was a fool. Even if he stayed past that spring to the next, such a man could never be happy closed up on my narrow shores. And even if somehow I found a way to keep him contented, yet still there were limits, for he was mortal and not young. Give thanks, I told myself. A winter is more than you had with Daedalus. I did not give thanks. I learned his favorite foods and smiled to see his pleasure in them. At night we sat together at the hearth and talked over the day. What do you think, I asked him, about the great oak struck by lightning? Do you think there is rot within?
I will look, he said. If there is, it will not be hard to take down. I will do it before dinner tomorrow.
He cut it down, then hacked the rest of the day at my brambles.
They were overrun. What you really need is some goats. A flock of four would have them flat in a month, and they'd keep it flat.
And where will I find goats? That word between us, Ithaca, like the breaking of a spell. Never mind, I said. I will transform a few of the sheep. That will fix it. At dinner, my nymphs had begun to linger near the men, to lead the ones they liked to their beds. This pleased me too, my household mingling with his. I had once told Daedalus that I would never marry, because my hands were dirty and I liked my work too much. But this was a man with his own dirty hands. And where, Circe, do you think he learned all these domestic niceties? My wife, he always said when he talked of her. My wife, my wife. Those words carried before him like a shield, like country folk who will not say the god of death's name for fear he will come and take their dearest heart. Penelope, she was called. While he slept, I would sometimes speak those syllables to the black air. It was a dare, or maybe proof. See, she does not come. She does not have the powers you believe. I held off as long as I could, but in the end she was the scab that I must pick. I waited for the sound of his breath that meant he was awake enough to talk. What is she like? He told me of her gentle manner, how her mild direction made men jump faster than any shout. She was an excellent swimmer. Her favorite flower was the crocus, and she wore the first bloom of the season in her hair for luck. He had a trick of speaking of her as if she were only in the next room, as if they were not 12 years and distant seas apart. She was Helen's cousin, he said. 1,000 times cleverer and wiser, though Helen was clever in her way, but of course fickle. I had heard his stories of Helen by then, queen of Sparta, mortal daughter of Zeus, most beautiful woman in the world. Paris, prince of Troy, had spirited her away from her husband Menelaus, and so started the war. Did she leave with Paris by choice, or was she forced? I asked. Who can say? For 10 years we were camped outside her gates, and she never tried to run that I heard. But the moment Menelaus stormed the city, she threw herself upon him naked, swearing it had been a torment and all she wanted was her husband back. You will never get the whole truth from her. She has as many coils as a snake, and an eye always to her advantage. Not unlike you, I thought. My wife, though, he said, she is constant. Constant in all things. Even wise men go astray sometimes, but never her. She is a fixed star, a true made bow. A silence in which I felt him moving deep among his memories. Nothing she says has a single meaning, nor a single intention, yet she is steady. She knows herself. The words slid into me, smooth as a polished knife. I had known he loved her from the moment he'd spoken of her weaving. Yet he had stayed, month after month, and I had let myself be lulled. Now I saw more clearly. All those nights in my bed had been only his traveler's wisdom. When you are in Egypt, you worship Isis. When in Anatolia, you kill a lamb for Cybele. It does not trespass on your Athena still at home. But even as I thought that, I knew it was not the whole answer. I remembered all the hours he had spent at war, managing the fine glass tempers of kings, the sulks of princes, balancing each proud warrior against his fellow. It was a feat equal to taming Aietes' fire-breathing bulls, with only his own wiles for aid. But back home in Ithaca, there would be no such fractious heroes, no councils, no midnight raids, no desperate stratagems that he must devise or men would die. And how would such a man go home again, to his fireside and his olives? His domestic harmony with me was closer to a sort of rehearsal, I realized. When he sat by the hearth, when he worked in my garden, he was trying to remember the trick of it. How an axe might feel in wood instead of flesh. How he might fit himself to Penelope again, smooth as one of Daedalus's joints. He slept beside me, every now and then his breath caught in the back of his throat. Tick. Pasiphae would have counseled me to make a love draught and bind him to me. Aietes would say I should steal away his wits. I imagined his face empty of all thoughts but what I put into it. He would sit at my knee, gazing up, fatuous and adoring and empty. The winter rains began, and the whole island smelled of earth. I loved the season, the cold sands, the white hellebore blooming. Odysseus had put on flesh, and did not wince so often when he moved. The worst of his tempers had ebbed. I tried to find satisfaction in it, like seeing a garden well tended, I told myself, like watching new lambs struggle to their feet. The men stayed close to the house, drinking themselves warm. For entertainment, Odysseus told them heroic stories of Achilles, Ajax, Diomedes, making them live again in the twilight air and perform their glorious deeds. The men were rapt, their faces struck with wonder. Remember, they whispered with awe, we walked among them. We stood against Hector. Our sons will tell the tale. He smiled over them like an indulgent father, but that night he scoffed. They could no more stand against Hector than a fly. Anyone with a brain ran when they saw him, including you. Of course, Ajax could barely hold against him, and only Achilles could have beaten him. I am a fair enough warrior, but I know where I end. He did, I thought. So many closed their eyes and spun fantasies of their wished-for strength. But he was mapped and surveyed, each stone and hummock noted with their clear-eyed precision. He measured his gifts to the scruple. I met Hector once, he said. It was the early days of the war, when we still pretended there might be a truce. He sat beside his father, Priam, on a rickety stool and made it look like a throne. He did not gleam like gold. He was not polished and perfect. But he was the same all the way through, like a block of marble cut whole from a quarry. His wife, Andromache, poured our wine. Later, we heard she bore him a son, Astyanax, commander of the city. But Hector called him Scamandrios, after the river that ran past Troy. Something in his voice. What happened to him? The same that happens to all sons of war. Achilles killed Hector, and after, when Achilles' son, Pyrrhus, stormed the palace, he took the child Astyanax and smashed open his head. It was a horror, like everything Pyrrhus did. But it was necessary. The child would have grown up with a blade in his heart. It is a son's highest duty to avenge his father. If he had lived, he would have rallied men to his side and come after us. The moon had slivered down to a shard outside the window. He was silent, turning through his thoughts. It is strange how comforting the idea is to me, that if I am killed, my son will take to the seas. He will hunt down those men who laid me low. He will stand before them and say, "You dared to spill the blood of Odysseus, and now yours is spilled in turn." The room was still. It was late. The owls long gone to their trees. "What was he like, your son?" He rubbed at the base of his thumb, where the awl puncture had been. "We named him Telemachus after my skill with the bow." Distant fighter, it meant. But the joke was that he screamed his whole first day as if he were living in the battlefield's heart. The women tried every trick they knew, rocking, walking, swaddling his arms, a thumb wetted with wine to suck. The midwife said she had never seen such passion. Even my old nurse was covering her ears. My wife had gone grey, for she feared there was something wrong with him. "Give him to me," I said. I held him up before me and looked into his screaming face. "Sweet son," I said, "you are right. This world is a wild and terrible place and worth shouting at. But you are safe now, and all of us need to sleep. Will you let us have a little peace?" And he calmed, just went quiet in my hands. After that, you could not find an easier child. He was always smiling, laughing for anyone who'd stopped to speak to him. The maids would invent excuses to come and pinch his fat cheeks. "What a king he will be one day," they would say, "mild as the west wind, oh." He went on with his memories. Telemachus's first bite of bread, his first word, how he loved goats and hiding beneath chairs, giggling to be found. He had more stories of his son from a single year, I thought, than my father had of me in all eternity. I know his mother will keep me in his mind, but I was leading the hunts by his age. I had killed a boar myself. I only hope there will still be something to teach him when I return. I want to leave some mark upon him. I said something vague and soothing, I'm sure. You will leave a mark. Every boy wants a father. He will wait for you. But I was thinking again of the relentlessness of mortal lives. Even as we spoke, the moments were passing. The sweet baby was vanished. His son was aging, growing, sharpening into a man. 13 years Odysseus had lost of him already. How many more? My thoughts returned often to that quiet-eyed, watchful boy. I wondered if he knew what his father expected, if he felt the weight of those hopes. I imagined him out on the cliffs every day praying for a ship. I imagined his weariness, his soft inward grief before he went to sleep each night, curling on his bed as he had once been cradled in his father's hands. I cupped my own hands in the dark. I did not have 1,000 wiles, and I was no fixed star, yet for the first time I felt something in that space, a hope, a living breath that might yet grow between.